must be spread all around the world between Islamic people in order to make the Islamic countries more stronger and to, inshallah, to beat the enemies of the Islamic people around the world.
Imam Khomeini is the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, who led the 1979 revolution against the Shah. He is widely respected among Muslims for his teachings and views on freedom and unity. He is also admired for his efforts towards the Palestinian cause. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
Following intense UN-supervised meetings between the warring sides in Yemen, the UN envoy for Yemen announced that the parties have agreed to renew the current truce in Yemen for two more months. The truce is extended under the same terms as the original agreement, which first came into effect on the 2nd of April.
When the United Nations agreed to our conditions, which included releasing the salaries of government employees, we saw that it was our duty to respond to the renewal of the truce, although we were aware that the enemy would not respect the truce as it did previously. But we adhere to peaceful solutions and we will make concessions in order to end the war.
Observers say renewing the truce is a win for the Yemenis, who stood alone during 7 years of war without any support from the international community or the United Nations.
The United Nations was absent throughout the years of war, and the armistice is not an achievement for the international body, but rather a success for Sana'a, which remained alone in facing war and siege without any support from the international community or any allies.
Grundberg said he will continue engaging with the parties to implement and consolidate all elements of the truce.
People, he hoped that renewing the UN brokered truce will build for a comprehensive political solution to end the war that devastated their lives and country. They say the international community should now step in properly to support the political process in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
France's government has warned, don't expect inflation to return to normal until the end of 2023. At nearly 6%, French inflation is the highest since 1985, and the government says the peak won't even be reached until this winter. It's a stunningly serious diagnosis. Inflation has seemingly been the number one voter complaint since the euro currency was introduced in 1999, and now it's worse than ever. Many are pointing the finger at the pan-European project, with Brussels demanding austerity and forcing Paris to ignore mass protests and public opinion.
This inflation is a symptom of the profound crisis caused by the policies of neoliberalism put in place since the 1980s. Above all, the policies seek merely to enrich stockholders and create constant dividends. This inflation is going to last, and the government is only making a wild guess that it will end by 2024.
Across the EU, only Malta has managed to keep inflation lower. France has been saved by its constantly derided socialist-inspired measures, such as caps on energy prices. However, many are demanding more price caps, re-indexed pensions, immediate bonuses, higher wages across the board, and especially for low-wage workers, in order to keep inflation from making the poverty rate skyrocket.
All the countries of the European Union are basically already in a recession. The 2008 financial crisis was followed by a forced era of austerity, which created a structural lack of demand and investment in Europe. Making massive public investments with efforts to an ecological transition would create both jobs and demand for goods and possibly avoid another Great Depression.
80% of France says they're watching their expenses more carefully, which seems likely to push France's consumer-driven economy officially into a recession next quarter. 70% are distrustful of their economic future, which is record pessimism so soon after a presidential election. After all the austerity, the French are being told to expect nearly 2 years of widespread economic hardship. That may not only affect this month's legislative elections, but it could lead to major social unrest yet again. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Okay. 150 foreign ambassadors and officials have visited Tehran to take part in the 33rd anniversary of the passing away of a man who changed the course of history in Iran, Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini was the founder of the Islamic Republic and the former leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which put an end to centuries of autocracy in Iran. Here, people believe the scale of Imam Khomeini's impact transcends Iran's boundaries.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran has proved to the Nigerian populace that if you are determined to eliminate any unjust leader and you follow the course, you can reach a result in some of the curriculum of the higher education in Nigeria. There are some space being open for Imam Khomeini to talk about the Imam Khomeini and the revolution of Islamic Republic in Nigeria curriculum of education.
Thanks to Imam Khomeini, we have witnessed a freedom-seeking movement forming in Muslim and even non-Muslim nations, which challenges imperialism and encourages dignity and independence from the global arrogance. This is the miracle of the Islamic Revolution.
Imam Khomeini passed away in 1989 at the age of 86, almost a decade after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which saw the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime in Iran, headed by Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, known as the Shah. Imam Khomeini spent many years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately ousted the Shah and led to the formation of the Islamic Republic.
For us, Imam Khomeini is a role model of resilience in the face of injustice. Today, we have come to renew our allegiance with him and the lessons that he taught us about self-reliance and resistance against the bullies of the world.
Imam Khomeini established the Islamic Republic following a referendum held in 1979, when, based on official reports, more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic.
Imam Khomeini is remembered here as the pioneer of a new era in Iran's history, an era that put centuries of monarchy behind and upended the Shah's domestic and foreign policies, replacing them with a political system that tries to rule the country based on the motto of independence from the West. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Russia's Institute of Oriental Studies held a ceremony in Moscow to remember the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. Leading Iranian Islamic scholars of Russia gathered to discuss the secrets behind the success of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. In his speech, senior advisor to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ghulam Ali Haddad-Adel, who is in Moscow, noted that independence and national identity are the two main elements of commonality between Iran and Russia.
We just need to look around a little at the changes taking place in the world. We will learn a lesson from the history of Iran-Russia relations over the past 50 years. They may well cooperate together in developing spiritual values. What happened to Iran and Russia over the past four decades is a confirmation of Imam Khomeini's correct ideas and statements about politics. Over the years, the ideological values and philosophy of the Western revolutionaries cause only questions and doubt. It looks weak. Khomeini philosophy, ideas, and even the prophetic thoughts after the passage of time only confirm to us the correctness and completeness of his assessment of today's political events.
On the sideline of the conference, participants visited the exhibition of Russian artist Sergei Feofanov, Flight of Simurgh, dedicated to the World Day of Memory and Millennium of Persian poet, classic of Persian literature Abu Qasem Ferdowsi. The presented works, both sculpture and paintings, were made during his trips to Iran.
We are all connected with Iran by the logic of a common culture. For example, in Russian literature, the fragment of the poem Shahnameh Ferdowsi has become part of Russian folklore. Yaroslan Lazarevich, the hero of the ancient Russian fairy tale, goes back to the ancient Persian epic about Rustam, and there are many such examples.
Russian-Iranian ties have a very long history. Cultural and scientific interaction has never been interrupted. Even today, Russian historians and scientists recall the mysticism and philosophy of Imam Khomeini's ideas. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Members of the Academic Forum of the Islamic Movement in Nigeria have visited Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki on the occasion of the anniversary of the passing away of the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. They described Imam Khomeini as a true leader who fought against oppression and injustice, not just in Iran, but everywhere around the world. Sheikh Zazaki described Imam Khomeini as an exemplary and upright leader who has become a role model for youths everywhere.
The academic forum consists of youths now. Now the youths who fought the revolution in the 70s are now old people. Now the ball is in the court of the youths up to today, particularly in Nigeria, where we find ourselves in a situation of chaos.
Sheikh Zazaki said Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution was an inspiration to many people around the world who want to establish truth and social justice. He said the legacy of Imam Khomeini still lives on several decades after his passing.
He has shown the world that Islam, which has governed the world in the old time, is capable of governing the world of our own time. He has also shown that the power is in the hand of the people. It is the duty of the people to rise up to change the situation in their places.
Members of the Academic Forum of the Islamic Movement said one of the basic lessons learned from Imam Khomeini is his stand against global oppression and arrogance. They said Imam Khomeini also emphasized Islamic unity and discouraged divisions in Islam. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
The father of the Islamic Revolution is how the Iranians remember Imam Khomeini on the 33rd anniversary of his passing. Congregating at his mausoleum in south of Tehran, Iranians once again paid tribute to Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic and the former leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which put an end to centuries of autocracy in Iran. As with every year, incumbent leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressed the nation. Imam Khomeini passed away in 1989 at the age of 86, almost a decade after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which saw the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime in Iran, headed by Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, known as the Shah. Imam Khomeini spent many years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement which ultimately ousted the Shah and led to the formation of the Islamic Republic, something which these people believe did not sit well with the West.
Imam Khomeini sought to free the country from foreign powers that had exploited our country's resources, including our oil. It's obvious that the revolution cut off the West's access to our resources, and that's why they've ever since been trying to deal a blow to the Islamic establishment.
People here view the revolution as an ideology, a legacy from Imam Khomeini that needs to be preserved against all odds, including the economic hardship that exists in Iran.
Inflation and high prices do exist here, which I hope will soon be solved, but this does not mean that we should abandon what we fought for back then. Our people gave blood to lead the revolution to victory, and we must preserve it.
We are the fourth generation of the Islamic Revolution, and we have come here to show the world that we will never turn our back on the revolution and our leader.
Imam Khomeini established the Islamic Republic following a referendum held in 1979, when, based on official reports, more than 98% of eligible Iranians voted yes to the Islamic Republic.
More than three decades after his passing, Imam Khomeini is still remembered as a man who changed the course of history in Iran, with ambitions for freedom and independence. People here believe his call for an independent Iran has been materialized, despite all of the economic and political pressures exerted by the West against Iran, which seek to isolate the Islamic Republic. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Ukraine war is moving full steam ahead. Russia has not only targeted weapons provided by the U.S. and its NATO allies, it has hit the capital, Kyiv. In another major escalation, Putin says that Russia will hit fresh targets if U.S. delivers long-range rockets. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the military might of either side will decide when this war will end, while questioning what a win would look like in the first place.
Tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine war are entering a new stage as Washington and its allies in Europe continue to send military equipment to Kyiv. The U.S.'s new plan to send long-range missiles to Ukraine has sparked a stark warning from Russia.
If they supply Ukraine with long-range missiles, we will draw the appropriate conclusions and use our weapons, of which we have enough, to strike targets we haven't yet hit.
Putin said Moscow is destroying U.S. weapons sent to Ukraine by the dozen. He said Russia is easily coping and targeting the shipments. Putin said the sole aim of the West supplying arms to Ukraine was to prolong the conflict for as long as possible. His warning was echoed by the Russian foreign minister. Sergei Lavrov warned the supply of advanced missile systems to Ukraine raises the risk of a third country getting dragged into the conflict.
The things that the Kyiv regime unapologetically demands from its Western patrons firstly overstep all bounds of decency and diplomatic relations, and secondly are a direct provocation aimed at drawing the West into combat.
On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden agreed to provide Ukraine with HIMARS multiple launch rocket systems as part of a $700 million weapons package.
The capabilities in this package include high mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, and guided munitions with a range of up to 70 kilometers, 5 counterartillery radars, 2 air surveillance radars, 1,000 additional javelins and 50 command launch units, 6,000 anti-armor weapons, 15,000 155-millimeter artillery rounds.
HIMARS is a mobile unit capable of simultaneously launching multiple precision-guided missiles up to 80 kilometers away. Since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Washington has approved 11 military assistance packages for Ukraine. The biggest was last month and worth $40 billion. European countries have also followed suit. Aside from that, the United States has provided intelligence that helped Ukrainians locate and strike Russian targets. But where does the line between supporting an ally and actively participating in the conflict lie? Many believe that gray zone is getting dangerously blurred. One wrong political move and the fighting in Ukraine could quickly become a war between Russia and NATO.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Don DeBar joins us. He's a journalist and activist from Westchester, New York. Also joining us is Cindy Sheehan, who's an anti-war activist who joins us from Sacramento.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Don DeBar, let me first start with you. We're looking at the most recent development here, and that is how Russia has launched this airstrike into Kyiv for the first time. Now, Russia has said that it has destroyed what it says was Western-supplied tanks and other armored vehicles, and the position that it targeted was actually on the outskirts of Kyiv, and these were supplies that were provided by U.S. and the European countries. Let's first look at that aspect of it, because It's the first time that this has happened, and that's the reason that Russia has given. Russia has stated that it's going to target weapons provided by either the U.S. and or NATO members. But is it also sending a message that it can target Kyiv?
Not only Kyiv, by the way. But Kiev, as we said it for, I don't know, the last 100 years. You know, just to remind people that Russia said that, you know, they could not come forward into Ukraine, that Russia would not allow it. And everyone ignored it, and they had the coup, and they, you know, shelled Donbass for 8 years, and they mobilized to go in and finish off Donbass, and the Russians came in and stopped them. Then they've, you know, acquired essentially eastern Ukraine. It's certainly behind the lines now. They can choose to, you know, at will pretty much keep it. Crimea is off the table as far as any realistic person is concerned. And they have the ability to rather easily, if they'd like to, either level Kyiv, they can do that pushing two or three buttons, or to take it, just to starve it and take it. And also Lviv, by the way, or Lviv, depending on your preference. And I think that you have to take seriously what they've done here after saying what they would do. When you consider Finland and Sweden joining NATO, because Finland will be facing a similar situation, finally. Not only can they strike Kyiv at will, and people are surprised at that, it may be a fiction that everyone else in the United States buys, and some of the European public, that the United States and NATO are not at war with Russia, but rather Russia and Kyiv are duking it out and we're helping an ally. Russian strategic planners and most serious adults on the planet realize, in fact, that's a lot of nonsense. That Russia and the United States are at war right now in Ukraine. And at some point in time, if the United States reaches into Russia deeply enough, Russia is going to reach into the United States. First, maybe you'll see Warsaw or perhaps even Berlin get a taste of that kind of a, you know, response. But they are perfectly capable of taking out New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, et cetera, if it gets there. And
okay,
they have said, look, that's what we'll do if that's where it goes. And yet, U.S. is going there, it seems.
That's a very fine point that that Don DeBar is making there, Cindy Sheehan, in terms of the warnings that Russia has given. I mean, from the year, well, I was about to say 2014 when the war started, really, but even prior to that, in terms of NATO's eastward expansion. So you can see how long Russia has waited. And now we're looking at the numerous times that Russia is issuing warnings after warning after warning that it's going to target U.S. and NATO's supplies. And here it has done so in Kyiv. The point here is why isn't the U.S. and NATO members taking that warning seriously? And or is that because they want this war to to continue, to prolong, so to speak?
Well, excuse me. I thank you for inviting me again. But I don't think that the United States and its NATO allies and, you know, other countries want this war to end, actually. I think that the profiteering is a huge factor in this. You know, if the United States is the biggest arms manufacturer and weapons dealer in the entire world, so how can the U.S. sell its arms and weapons if there aren't any wars? So I think that Putin and Russia have been very, you know, patient. They were actually very patient for at least these 8 years, like you said, and like Don was saying, how the West and Ukraine has tried to provoke, and NATO has tried to provoke Russia into this situation. And it reminds me of the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 1962 when I was only 5 years old. I know it's hard to imagine that I was ever that young, but I remember how it was the major topic and how all the adults around me were so nervous and worried and upset. And here in the United States, it just seems to be like, you know, the people here in the U.S. are blithely or blandly or whatever watching the U.S. provoke Russia into nuclear annihilation, which has been a real nightmare, you know, ever since I was born, ever since the U.S. dropped two atomic bombs on Japan. And so it's very despicable that anybody would want to profit off of this killing, the potential annihilation of life on the planet. And, you know, it just is, it just shows to what lengths that these people will go to for their profit. And it almost seems like this horrible James Bond movie for world domination. You know, it's scary to be adult in this time, seeing these things, just thinking, is there a future for my children and grandchildren? And it's really not a topic of conversation. The topic is support Ukraine, and if you don't support Ukraine, that means you must be a Trump supporter. It's just really crazy. It's just super crazy here. I think Don would verify that.
Well, let's talk about Americans then, since you're talking about it right now. Don DeBar, I couldn't help but looking at one of the sound bites of an American in California at a particular gas station who was pumping her BMW SUV, saying that we got to stand with Ukraine because even though the gas prices are so high. So the reason why, I mean, that's one side of the story. The other side are the general public. The general public is watching. The last time around, we had, what, $700 million of military aid that the U.S., I guess, got approved. And I'm not too sure if you're a fan of Senator Rand Paul, but I'm going to quote him: no matter how sympathetic the cause, my oath of office is to the national security of the U.S. And, of course, saying that here we have, you know, all this money going towards Ukraine when the Americans could use it. They could use it in many ways. So is that an aspect that the U.S. president looks at and says, it's okay, we got to go with Ukraine?
Well, the U.S. president looks at his teleprompter and he says whatever it tells him to say. I think that's widely known around the planet now. You know, first of all, what Cindy said is absolutely true. This is like whatever else it is. It is also a massive exercise in profiteering. Now, you know, the $700 million that you just referenced is the most recent tranche, but it was a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, they approved almost unanimously in the two houses of Congress $40 billion to Ukraine, and that was the second tranche this year. There was 13.6 before that. The $40 billion is intended to cover a five-month period to basically fund the war for 5 months. Now, annualized, $40 billion for 5 months is $100 billion for a year. And at $100 billion a year, you are almost 50% over the annual military budget of Russia. Only Russia's $65 million a year military budget provides for a military to fight a war in the Baltics, if need be, in Ukraine, if need be, in Poland, if need be, in the Sea of Japan, if need be, and in the off the Korean Peninsula. In other words, the expanse of about a sixth of the surface area of the planet. Russia defends itself with $65 billion. At just this crunch point in Ukraine, we're throwing in the equivalent of $100 billion. Does not include the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, and the rest. That's the first part. The second part is, if you look at how much money that actually is, okay, the total housing budget of the federal government, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, annually is about $45 billion. Now, we have millions of people in foreclosure, millions of people in eviction, hundreds of thousands to millions in the streets, and the condition is deteriorating, and yet we are giving enough to double our budget to Ukraine to cover 5 months worth of war with Russia at Russia's borders. You know, it's insane.
You know, it's interesting. Let me get your idea. Since you mentioned about how the money that's given so far by the U.S. Actually is almost the entire defense budget of Russia. So if you put the two together, then they are spending that much. They should have made more advances. They, meaning the U.S. and its NATO countries, compared to Russia. We're going to talk about the narrative. But am I correct to look at it that way?
I think so. You know, okay. Well, I think that, first of all, if you take a look at what they actually get for that, you know, first of all, if you're going to buy armaments, you need to have an army. I mean, the population of Ukraine is less than a third of the population of Russia.
Correct.
Half, or at least a third, their actual loyalty is to Russia. They're Russians. Also, the group that is in charge of Ukraine, the Nazis that are there, they're a distinct minority among the population. That's always how Nazis rule, by the way. They're brought to power by the rich, because that's whose interest they serve, and they get a group of people who are very desperate, excited, and make them crazy and intimidate the rest of the population. But you can't field an army with that,
right?
Unless you have the numbers, and they don't.
We have to talk about that. We have to talk about the foreign, I don't know what you want to call them. The Department of Homeland Security called them American white nationalists. My question to Cindy Sheehan. According to a report that was released by the DHS, U.S. fascists are fighting in Ukraine. American white nationalists with documented histories of violence are obtaining combat experience with advanced U.S.-made weapons. Now, the focus of this release was not so much about Ukraine, but the fact that the DHS is worried that these American fascist white nationalists, whatever you want to call them, are going to come back to the States and they're going to be radicalized. That was the gist I got from the article. But the fact that they're there, and the fact that you have, according to the DHS, that they are these white nationalists or fascists that include violent extremists that are actually being recruited at embassy in Washington, D.C. and consulates across the U.S. sheds another light. First of all, do you think that that's true? I mean, I'm assuming it is. The DHS came out. But, I mean, that really puts things into a different perspective when it comes to this particular segment who's in the war in Ukraine.
It's a news to me, but I am having some echo. I have echo when I talk. Anyway, I don't know if that's true, but they're going to fight with the Azov Battalion, the Nazis in Ukraine. Is that what the
It says, Cindy Sheehan, it says, that the Department of Homeland Security, which has been gathering intelligence on Americans who have joined the ranks of more than 20,000 foreign volunteers. I'm assuming they are going to be fighting within or with the members of the Azov Battalion, Azov Movement, who are actively recruiting either ethnically motivated or violent extremists or these types of characters, which the U.S., with the participation of the U.S., it's hard to verify all of this. I can't argue against the DHS, you see, because it's not something that's covered so much by media outlets or by online news organizations.
Well, of course, we have to give anything that comes out of the U.S. government, we have to treat it with a grain of salt, and we have to try to verify it from independent sources. But, you know, we do know that many, people who wanted to go fight in a war, Americans went to Ukraine to sign up to fight against Russia. And we've seen from these same Americans who escaped from the Ukraine that they were put in these situations with guns that had very few bullets. They were essentially being used as human shields, and they had their passports taken away from them when they got there. So they had to sneak across the border into Poland, you know, using organizations like the American Red Cross to help them get over the border. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if it is true. But it's certainly not like the communists and socialists who joined to go fight against fascism in Spain in the 1930s, it's certainly is a different cause. But we see, it's hard because we see here in the United States, we see people of all political stripes supporting the government in Kiev that has been sympathetic to Nazi elements. So we have widespread support for that here in the United States.
Don DeBar, I got to get your opinion on this also. First of all, the whole Azov movement, if you want to call it that, the Azov Battalion, and also the fact that the DHS has come out and saying that you have these white supremacists or white nationalists from the U.S. who are there fighting. What do you think?
Right. Well, yes, there are that. You know, I've spoken with Ava Bartlett and some others on the ground there, and in fact, that's true. Also, some have been captured, and some have come out. And what Cindy said is correct, that they've been lose their passports, and they're trapped in there. Once they get a body in there, they said that we're cannon fodder. These are Americans. The DHS sentiment, or whatever they're expressing in this memorandum, certainly it's a valid point. If you look at Al Qaeda and 9/11, for example, the blowback thing. I'm not so sure that this is, you know, an anti-policy of the government. In other words, I'm not so sure DHS is really concerned about it, and in fact, perhaps they're actually cultivating these things. But I would like to point out, maybe 4 years ago, having conversations, with folks here on Press TV and elsewhere, when shortly after Trump took office. In some schools, for example, somebody drew a swastika on a piece of toilet paper or, on a chalkboard, said, some slur or whatever that indicated that they were ultra-nationalist, right-wing Nazi types. And the whole country went bananas over this stuff. It was an indication that Trump was a Nazi and anyone who uttered his name without vomiting was a Nazi or whatever. And we have Biden here. First, we have Obama and Biden and Clinton installing Nazis in control of Ukraine back in 2014, actively, even on the telephone with Vicky Nuland. And now we have Biden arming and training and, ready to go to World War III with Nazis, on behalf of Nazis, hiring the Nazis in essence, and nobody's saying a word about it. In fact, if you point it out in social media, you get deplatformed for a while. That we are in bed, to the extent that these people are really Nazis and not like crisis actors, then we're in bed with Nazis completely, with the covers over our heads. And that should be of concern to people here, whether they come back here or not, because it means the Nazis are already in control of the U.S. government here. We don't have to worry about some knuckleheads coming back with rifle skills and taking over the country. They're already in charge.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, we're quickly running out of time over here. I'm not too sure how to go about my last question, but Cindy Sheehan, what I'm looking at over here are the issue of sanctions against Russia. I mean, it is widely believed that it's not having the effect, the ultimate effect that the U.S. and its European allies wanted. I mean, the Europeans especially couldn't even have a unified stance when it comes to purchases of Russian oil and gas. I mean, oil they can maybe replace, but gas they can't. And they had to exempt some of the EU member countries from that. Well, that means that the Russia is going to still continue generating revenue. So, and of course, we're looking at inflation, and we're looking at all the different consequences that's impacting all the countries across the world, really, but in particular the U.S. and the EU suffering from over 8% inflation. How much longer do you think that the U.S. and the European allies, NATO members in particular, are going to go after this war?
Well, what we need to understand here is the United States has had sanction regime for decades. They have embargoed Cuba. And so the U.S. uses sanctions to hurt, as anybody in Iran knows, to hurt the people of the country. And what we're seeing here with the sanctions against Russia is that they're backfiring and the chickens are essentially coming home to roost, because the sanctions are causing more inflation and, hyperinflation and problems here in the United States.
Let me give 30 seconds to Donabar. Donabar, Ukraine wants missiles to reach Russia. U.S. says no. Why do you think that is? And do you think that the U.S. is just a step away from actually providing those missiles?
Well, in fact, the U.S. has provided them. They're just saying that they have governors or they're not, don't have enough booster or whatever to reach Russia. You know, all you have to do is drive a little closer to the border, and then suddenly it reaches. Russia has said, look, if you give somebody weapons and they use them against us, there's going to be a point in time when we're going to use our weapons against you, and we have some pretty powerful weapons that you're not going to want to see.
Thank you. Don DeBar, journalist and activist from Westchester, New York. Cindy Sheehan, thank you so much. Anti-war activist from Sacramento. And with that, we'll come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. From the market. Guess what I have bought? A beautiful plant? No. Kitchenwares? Oh no. Let me tell you what I have here. A beautiful pink blouse. Oh, I love the color pink. This blouse has a very delicate pink color. It's attractive. Did you know that the sky on Mars appears pink? Very exciting. I wish I could travel to Mars and produce a report from the pink sky on Mars for you. Well, now that I can't travel to Mars, let me take you to a beautiful lake in Fars province. Believe it or not, this lake is pink. Yes, the name of this lake is Maharlu. Maharlu Lake is one of the lakes of Fars province in Iran. This lake is located 20 kilometers southeast of Shiraz and its area is 600 square kilometers. The longest part of this lake is 28 kilometers, while the widest part of it is 15 kilometers. Its deepest part also reaches 3 meters. Maharlu Lake is very salty and it is considered as one of the largest mineral deposits in the dry seasons of the year in Iran. This lake feeds from three seasonal rivers including Sultanabad, Sarvestan and Khoshk River. The lake water typically evaporates by the end of summer and exposes the white lake bed. By mid-summer and due to high evaporation rates and salt concentrations, the lake water turns reddish. This lake is blue in the rainy seasons of the year. Maharlu Lake, due to its high salinity of water and abundant light, is growing algae, which is called Donalia salina. It creates a sort of organic beta-carotene that causes changes in the color of the lake into pink. This phenomenon usually happens during the month of May.
I am now standing beside the Maharlu Lake. Believe it or not, this lake appears pink. A pinkish pink. Wonderful. Extraordinary. Unique. However, the lake's shore is full of salt and looks white. Don't poke fun at me, but at the first glance, I thought these white stuff were snow. Most of them flamingos. This lake is home to an aquatic crustacean called Artemia. Flamingos love eating the Artemia. There are also other birds here. Some of them include heron, duck, and plover. Also, around the lake, animals like jackal, hyena, fox, and wildcat inhabit. Oh, this diversity is great. Maharlu Village is located near Maharlu Lake, and of course, after fully visiting this lake, I'll take a tour to the village. The local guide told me that this village has many spectacular sights to see, including an old cemetery, a historical caravanserai, and a spring which has sulfur water. The vast, beautiful land of Iran is full of natural sceneries and many spectacular, historical, and wonderful places to visit. I love Iran.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.